Paul, the Apostle by Grace, by Brother John Mitchell. Chapter 20. A Trip to Jerusalem. The mindset and intentions of the Apostle Paul when he finally decided to leave Corinth are hard to determine. Was he swayed by the resolve of his much-travelled companions, Aquila and Priscilla, to move on, now that the season for voyaging across the Aegean Sea had arrived? Or did he feel he had fulfilled his Lord's commission in converting many Corinthians to the faith, and that he could leave them to mature a little before coming back to them again? But what of their guidance meantime? There's no record that Paul left either Silas or Timothy, or both of them, in charge after his departure. Indeed, Silas, who'd been the staunch and faithful supporter of the Apostle, especially during his first missionary journey, disappears from the record altogether, until much later when he turns up in Rome, serving the Apostle Peter as a faithful brother, and carrying Peter's letter to, amongst others, the ecclesias he'd helped Paul to found. Which in turn raises the question of the services by this time of both Silas and Timothy. Was Timothy, whom Paul had treated as his own son in the faith, now sufficiently matured as to free Silas for other services elsewhere? Certainly Timothy had been groomed more and more for independent commissions superintended by Paul. Then there is the question of the vow and the cutting of the hair that Luke mentioned before the party left Corinth, which some commentators attribute to Aquila and some to Paul, but no one has an inkling as to what their significance was. So leaving these imponderables and others aside, the definite information is that Paul had stayed in Corinth well beyond 18 months, when he left the brethren there and sailed east for his ultimate destination, Syria. After a voyage of 300 miles, lasting less than a week, the first port of call was Ephesus, the capital of Asia Minor, in the region that the Lord had prevented Paul from traversing during his first missionary journey. Nor was there time on this trip also for a long stay. Paul managed to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath, introduce himself to the Jews and reason with them regarding the hope of Israel. And although what he had to say aroused considerable interest and resulted in their requesting him to stay longer, the apostle declined. But as he left, he promised, "I will come back if it is God's will." No reason is given in modern versions for so fleeting a visit, but some ancient manuscripts state that Paul wanted to be on his way so as to arrive in Jerusalem for a certain feast, most likely Pentecost, at the end of May. Whether in the end he fulfilled that hope is doubtful, since his stay in Jerusalem seems to have been as fleeting as that in Ephesus. Sailing from Ephesus, Paul landed at Caesarea and went from there up to Jerusalem. The brevity of Luke's account of what happened when he reported to the Jerusalem ecclesia and saluted or greeted the brethren there, and then went down to Antioch, has caused much speculation as to the reception they gave him. Bearing in mind that it was the Pharisaical element in the Jerusalem ecclesia that, despite the ruling of the Jerusalem conference, had twice tried to deny the Gentiles their freedom from having to observe aspects of the law of Moses, and was still fomenting trouble in ecclesias elsewhere, it's easy to imagine that they gave him less than a hearty reception, and were not enamoured of his success in bringing many more Gentiles into the fold. However it was, Paul seems to have lost no time in going down to Antioch in Syria, the intended terminus of his journey and the springboard of his ministry to the Gentiles. There the atmosphere was bound to have been lighter and freer than in the midst of Jewish orthodoxy. Meanwhile, a significant happening had taken place in the Ephesian port Paul had so recently quitted. A Jew named Apollos, who was a native of Alexandria, had arrived and had created a stir in the synagogue with the fervour of his preaching about the Lord Jesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures, who had been instructed in the way of the Lord, though he only knew the baptism of John. What that seems to imply is that his knowledge, based on the preaching of John regarding the Messiah, enabled him to preach fervently and accurate about Jesus, whilst stopping short of the significance and outcome of his sacrifice. It is If, as is generally assumed, Apollos was a product of the famous Alexandrian school of Philo, which was to the Jews in Egypt parallel to that of Gamaliel in Jerusalem, this visitor had been similarly equipped in scholarship as Paul himself was in his younger days. When Priscilla and Aquila had heard Apollos and had been greatly impressed by him, they invited him to their home, but having themselves been thoroughly instructed by Paul in Corinth on a daily basis, they were well qualified to explain to him the way of God more perfectly. Nor does this seem to have been their only exercise in the Gospel. For despite the fleeting nature of Paul's recent visit to Ephesus, during which he only got so far as to reason with the Jews, a number of them had since become brothers. And when Apollos decided to move on, they were prepared to help him. How that decision came about is uncertain, but some suppose that in the busy commerce between Corinth and Ephesus, some brethren from Corinth had visited Ephesus, and having heard Apollos preach, were keen to have him preach in their ecclesia also, because in the parlance of today he was a good speaker. In whatever way it came about, Apollos expressed a wish to go to Achaia, and the brothers in Ephesus encouraged him, and wrote to the disciples in Corinth to welcome him. On arriving, says Luke, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed, for he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Messiah. In fact, Apollos so impressed a section of the brethren in Corinth with his preaching that they considered him superior in this regard to the apostle who had converted them. This personalising of the gospel and the ensuing factions within the ecclesia were bound to cause trouble such as Apollos never intended, and the outcome was to provide an example of human failing that has bedevilled ecclesias throughout history. Therefore, it is not surprising that Paul, when he heard of it, used a directness and fervour that even Apollos could not have matched. "You are still worldly," he wrote in a letter to Corinth. "But since there is jealousy and quarrelling amongst you, are you not worldly? Are you not acting like mere men? For when one says, 'I follow Paul,' and another, 'I follow Apollos,' are you not mere men? What, after all, is Apollos? And what is Paul? Only servants through whom you came to believe. As the Lord has assigned each to his task, I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. The man who plants and the man who waters has one purpose, and each will be rewarded according to his own labour. For we are God's fellow workers, and you are God's field, God's building." Thus, what might have resulted in a division within the Corinthian ecclesia was quelled. And what might have caused jealousy and resentment between Paul and Apollos, had they also been worldly, was avoided. When the pair met again in Ephesus, Paul urged him to return to Corinth and continue his work there, but Apollos replied discreetly that he was unwilling to go just then, but would do so when he had another opportunity. True servants, both of them, were they of their Lord.